okay. Yeah. That can be a real pain. Yes, this is my putative plan for the lecture then. And I know that we're kind of getting slightly 2 weeks high, 2 weeks ahead. Well, not quite, but obviously we're kind of anticipating a little bit the seminars tomorrow. So I'm trying not to double up too much and to leave you. I think what you might need to do actually, girls, is just to drag those along there. Fence, which you prefer, rather than having to face the wall. So you guys might need to just move in. Or move the table, yeah, whichever you find easier. Has everybody managed to read the extract that I gave you? Yeah, it's not too long, is it? So we'll talk about, I'm hoping that you'll come with lots of ideas about that tomorrow and the kind of close analysis. You'll see that Janessa certainly has already put up your document. Gemma, has your document gone up on the forum as well now? So both documents from these two volunteers. And there may be others as well who've done this as well. Yeah, Charlotte has. Yeah, and Vicky has too. There's stuff on the forum that relates to the people who are just doing a literature kind of review, a critical review for us next week. So, tomorrow rather. So if you haven't yet read that, perhaps you could have a look, go onto the forum before tomorrow and just look at those summaries and we'll go through them in class tomorrow, okay? Otherwise, I look forward to hearing your ideas on the text. What we're going to look at today, then, is the question of obstetric texts in French. You know, the very fact that they exist at all in the Renaissance, or I should say the Renaissance text, is of interest. And I'm going to take you, by way of contextualisation, really, through what exists alongside Louise Bourgeois' text, okay? And we're going to look particularly at the power struggles that emerge as it were, not so much out of those texts, but the power struggles that those texts clearly indicate to us, which is that there is a kind of mother, midwife, doctor, authoritative power struggle potentially in some of these texts at least. And there's also the question of the practitioner also being a writer and how easily that sits. You know, these are medical men and women, by and large men, in fact exclusively men, apart from Louise Bourgeois, but they're also turning their hands to text. And then from that, we're going to look more closely at Louise Bourgeois herself, her ethics and values as a midwife, and the idea of the relationship she has with the mothers in her charge, the notion of her position in society, if you like, and then her own appreciation of herself as writer. And finally, we'll end just by talking about the case study of the birth of Louis XIII, which is the text that you're going to go on to look at next week. And I'll talk to you more about that in the seminar tomorrow. Okay, so Renaissance obstetrics then. Well, if you'll pardon the pun, this is a particularly fertile topic in France in our period. There's a great interest in obstetrics, and there are a large number of publications, an uncharacteristically large number if you compare it with other European countries in the period. So there are many publications, both in Latin, as one might expect, and Latin being the language read by the medical establishment, medical authorities and so forth, doctors in other words, and in French. So yeah, Latin works belong in the domain of the university, so those who were qualified doctors who belonged to the establishment, belonged to the university, would certainly be expected to read Latin and know these texts well. French works, on the other hand, those that we're going to look at, several of these were in fact written by doctors, but doctors who were concerned to disseminate their knowledge more widely. Some of them were also penned by surgeons. Now, surgeons weren't necessarily members of the highest ranks of the male medical establishment, and therefore they weren't always thoroughly schooled in Latin, and therefore having access to a text in the vernacular could be of interest and of use in terms of improving their best practice. There was, I think, or one can see articulated in these texts, a real desire to alleviate the suffering of women and generally to improve practice. And there was, I should say, an anxiety about the role of the midwife in the birth procedure and the question of whether the midwife always acted properly, always acted in the best interest of the patient, and so forth. So there was some concern about female ignorance in the domain of obstetrics. Okay. Right, so all those texts that exist in French, we might want to think a little bit about the reasons for writing in French in this period in a bit more detail. So first of all, then, you really have, I think, emerging in this period, a curiosity about the subject, a curiosity about obstetrics, so therefore a desire, as I say, to show knowledge. The presentation of texts in the vernacular in order to remedy ignorance. As I said, anxiety about the lack of knowledge of many midwives. There's also a desire, I think, to educate women, lay women, who might want to know more about their own bodies. Okay. And I think this is the dual aim that Louise Bourgeois also has. She's educating her daughter, who is a would-be midwife, but also other women in the community. These texts could also be a remedy for the problems of pudeur. Okay, pudeur.
Looking for...
Okay. To be more precise, women in this period, some women were certainly afraid to consult male doctors or surgeons about a part of the body that was considered shameful. So it was thought that manuals available to women in French would enable them to deal with, or at least partially deal with, the problem themselves. Okay. And I think also there's a real desire to share knowledge and celebrate knowledge and discovery in this area. So, for instance, some of these texts celebrate obstetrics as part of a wider celebration of the wondrous gifts of the natural world, that kind of idea. It's true to say that, that much of what's celebrated as marvellous, we might perceive as actually quite strange in terms of medical ideas, ideas about the female body. And many of those ideas, in fact, hark back to the medieval period and to ancient texts before that. There's still a desire to celebrate. And of course, you know, with the emergence and real kind of taking off, as it were, the printing press, that desire to celebrate and disseminate information will only increase throughout the Renaissance and into the 17th century, as we'll see. So, good reasons for writing in French, but also anxiety about the fact that obstetric texts may be available in the vernacular. Okay, why? Well, because these chaps, the male medical establishment, felt threatened to some degree. There was an anxiety that these texts may compromise their unique status, their unique authority in the medical world. So that was one sort of anxiety. Another sort of anxiety was that texts may somehow instruct lay people in the practice of abortion. So too much information can be a bad thing, a dangerous thing, that kind of idea. It was also perceived that some of these texts might be considered to constitute a moral threat because they discuss parts of the body considered shameful. So should ordinary men and women have access to the discussion of this kind of material? That was a real anxiety. And we see in the preface to one text, for instance, articulated, well, there's a kind of discussion, in fact, between... somebody who is clearly part of the male medical establishment and is very anxious about this knowledge getting out, and another doctor who is saying, well, you know, actually what's available here in French is no more shocking or titillating than something we might find in Marguerite and Albazette Camemont, for example. So those of you who looked at that text with me last year, you'll know the content of that, but you'll see that there is a sense of some practitioners wanting to say, well, hang on, the novel might deal with intimacy, male-female intimacy. Poetry may also deal with this, so is it such a problem that some of these texts also treat this subject? There are also more pragmatic considerations, like the question of how you might translate terminology from Latin into French, and the number of terms were inherited from ancient texts, for example. How would these then be translated? And in fact, one of the ways in which some of those doctors writing in French preserved a sense of hierarchy with respect to these texts was to essentially translate into French, but to reserve some parts that would only appear in Latin within the body of the French text. And that might apply to things like prescriptions, what we call recipes or remedies. Sometimes it was thought it might be rather dangerous for those to appear in the vernacular, and so they didn't, for instance. Okay. And on that question of remedies, there was a real anxiety, I think, about the question of what you would include in these kind of texts. For instance, if those writing these kind of texts were to acknowledge that women certainly had more hands-on experience in this area, how far would they go in including women's remedies for ailments in pregnancy, women's recipes and so forth? Are these now going to be credited with too much significance because they're being written down? So that process of writing somehow authenticates something which has previously only been an oral craft, if you see what I mean. Okay? And of course, you know, as you begin to write, so you begin as a writer to ask yourself questions about expression and style. So rhetorical strategies also become important. And some of the prefaces to these texts articulate these kind of questions. Okay? Now, I should say that this information has become much easier to find since the publication of this work. And there's a copy in the library. It's a slightly curious work, but you might find it slightly curious, because what it is a collection of all the liminary material, all the prefaces and letters and so forth that preceded these obstetric texts in French. But in fact, what you get from that is lots of information about the discussions that were at issue about the production of these texts. And so you can kind of flick through from writer to writer, and whilst you don't get extracts from the body of those texts themselves, you get a real idea of what would be contained within them from the dedications to the reader that precede them, from the letters to a particular patron, that kind of thing. Okay. Plus there are one or two illustrations, and what you get is, if I can find it, you know, a real sense of what actually those publications looked like. So worth looking at that in the library if you're interested in more background information. So what have we got then available in French in this period? Well, there's a text called the Trotula, okay, which actually comes from the medieval period, as you can see. 12th century Latin version disseminated very widely throughout Europe and then translated into French during the Middle Ages, and that was a source of information, certainly. It was a manual on women's illnesses of all kinds for the attention of doctors, barber surgeons, midwives, and ordinary women who could read. Okay. So it's the earliest well-known example of this kind of text. Okay. I'll put this on the web, by the way, this presentation, so you can have a look at this. Next in line comes a work by Rösslin, so a German writer who creates a manual for midwives, as you can see, in 1513, which is then translated into French in 1536. And you'll see, actually, there's also a Latin version produced in 1532. So this is a text which doctors would have read in Latin and other practitioners in French, and those translations coming close together. Popular work, lots of editions up to the beginning of the 17th century. Okay, and just here I've quoted a little bit of the Au Lecteur preceding this text. Il me semblerait trop nécessaire que les gardes d'accoucher et celles qu'on appelle sage-femme ou matrone sussent ces secrets, so the information contained in this text, sur le doigt, this must be on the tip of their tongues, as it were, at hand, pour souvenir à telles incommodités que plus souvent sont causes de grands dangers. So you've got this fear, if you like, that there is ignorance amongst those women who regularly attend births. And some of that might be eradicated by the production of this kind of text. And there was real ignorance out there. For instance, there's documentary evidence that many women who weren't really trained as midwives, who were simply kind of what is called in this text the garde d'accoucher or matrone, their basic principle for delivering a child was to get that child out as quickly as possible. So if there were problems in the delivery, they wouldn't know how to handle that necessarily. And what they would do was try and push the child out or try and pull the child out in a way that did real damage to the child and to the mother. And I won't go into the details because they're not very pleasant. But it's that kind of ignorance about how to deliver a child in cases of difficulty that was a real worry for practitioners and something that they wanted eradicated. Now, Antoine Paré mentioned him last week, okay? Paré, then surgeon to four kings of France, actually, and Louise Boursier's husband works under Paré. Okay? He's not a member of the Faculty of Medicine, he's not thoroughly integrated into the male medical elites, but he's very much pro sharing knowledge and producing medical texts in the vernacular for the benefit of women, yes, but also surgeons, okay? And surgeons potentially having more hands-on experience than doctors. And he talks a little bit about this. What he talks about here in the quote I've given you is the fact that he got to read Galen, so an ancient medical source, because someone translated it into French. So he says, I wasn't someone that knew Latin well enough to read Galen, but Monsieur Maître Jean Canapé translated this text into French, and therefore I was able to read it. Je proteste que nous sommes tous à lui grandement obligés parce que il nous a traduit en français plusieurs livres exquis et nécessaires à la consommation de notre art. And then he goes on to talk about his hands-on experience in the field. N'ai entrepris d'écrire ce traité, sinon après avoir, par espace de longtemps, mis la main à l'œuvre, tant à la maison de l'Hôtel Dieu. Now, the Hôtel Dieu was a hospital, Jonas, you might be mentioning this a little bit tomorrow, didn't you? The guilds?
Yes.
That? Yes, good, okay. So we'll come back to the Hôtel Dieu tomorrow, but certainly Louise Bourgeois mentions that. So he talks also about having experienced au guerre et autres lieux. So he's worked on the battlefield, he's got hands-on experience. This is very similar to the kind of claims Louise Bourgeois would make. And that real defence of translating into French to remedy ignorance. Okay. Guillaume Chrétien translates Hippocrates, so we see another ancient text then becoming available. And also he translates the work of another doctor. Chrétien, I should say, was himself a doctor. And in fact, the work was dedicated primarily for male practitioners and also for femmes vertueuses, okay? So virtuous laywomen, and again, laywomen who could read, okay? But this is interesting. What he says in his preface to the translation of Dubois, another doctor, vous prenez volontiers grand plaisir à entendre tel secret, okay? He's dedicating this to this Duchess de Bouillon, qui ne sont communément connus à tous pour charitablement en aider et faire secours aux femmes tant pusillanimes et craintives qui le sembleraient avoir engagé leur honneur ou offensé leur pudicité si elles découvraient leur grief passion aux médecins doctes et bien expérimentés. I don't know if you're quite picking up the sense of that, but this word découvrait here, meaning to reveal. So these women, he's saying, will be very anxious to reveal their gynecological problems to doctors, to médecins doctes bien expérimentés. Too much fear involved, therefore this kind of text could help them. Okay. Jean Liébeau, okay, this is just to give you a rather nice picture of one aspect of anatomy or understanding of the body in this period. And what you've got here, I can let you read most of this in your own time, is talk about breast milk and where it comes from. And as you can see, vous voyez que nature nourrit dans la matrice l'enfant de son menstruel. So whilst the child is inside, it's nourished by menstrual blood, if you like. C'est une merveille qu'aussitôt qu'il est sorti en lumière, le sang rebrousse en haut par les mammilières et se jette dans les cavités de la mamelle où il se convertit en lait. Now, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, one of the articles
for
some
of them. Yeah, so the blood travels up from the womb into the breast and converts itself into milk. So you talk about... So it moves from being white to being red to being white, and then continues to nourish the child, as it were, when the child is on the outside of the body. So just to show you how, you know, our understanding of the body has changed, and this quote is rather similarly from Jacques Guillaumeau. This is really important. These two texts are really important because Guillaumeau is a contemporary of Louise Bourgeois, and they clash. At a certain point, as we'll see in a moment. But this paragraph is all about breast milk and different types of breast milk. And you'll see, okay, il n'y a aucune comparaison pour la nourriture de la nourrice avec celle de la propre mère. So mother's breast milk is much better than that of a nourrice or a nurse, okay? Il faut croire que l'enfant, en tétant le lait de la nourrice, qui sera vicieuse, suce aussi les vices et malices du sel. So if there's a moral problem with the wet nurse, the child will digest that problem via the milk. And you get that again in the second bit of the quote, okay? Encore que l'enfant soit soit né d'un bon père et une bonne mère, si est-ce que la mauvaise nourriture d'une méchante nourrice le fera vicieux et méchant. So however good your parent is, if you have a bad wet nurse, you will be transformed morally by the breast milk that you digest. And we see this idea also coming through Louise Bourgeois. You might already have noticed it in that text. So just to give you an idea of the differences then that one might see in this period. And finally, and I'll let you really read this through in detail in your own time, but this is Charles Guillaumeau. It was a father and son team, and the son kind of modified and added to the text written by the father. They were both doctors. This is a quite strong, rather vitriolic criticism of midwives, and as I've said, it's really anti-Louise Bourgeois polemic that we're seeing here. It's her and her text that he's targeting when he says, midwives don't always know what they're doing. Sometimes they think they do know what they're doing, but they often suffer from ignorance and pride. And if you just unpick that, it's quite important to do that, I think. You really feel that sense of a competition between the world of the midwife on the one hand and the world of the male medical establishment on the other. Okay. I'll come back to that tomorrow in the seminar. Okay, so what Worth does, once she's looked at all these, is to suggest that, in fact, the general consensus in this period was that, in spite of this plethora of new works on the body, by and large, the texts are looking back to medieval works on obstetrics and ancient texts on obstetrics, rather than looking forward, if you like. So some major discoveries are still to take place, and I think various people will talk to us about that tomorrow in terms of kind of medical discoveries. So I won't anticipate that too much now. But there's certainly plenty of reading you can do on the understanding of the body in this period. Okay. For instance, nobody had any idea yet about the existence of ovaries and production of a female egg. There was a lot still to learn. Despite dissection, obviously, contributing to knowledge in this period, there was still a lot to learn. Okay, so that gives you a bit of context. We're now going to look at Louise Bourgeois and her ethics and values. Okay. Now, on page 184 in the text that you've got, she uses a rather attractive extended metaphor to describe her craft. She says that the midwife can be compared to un grand pilote maître conducteur, okay, of a vaisseau de grande importance. So rather like the sailor, the captain of a vessel, the vessel being the mother's body in the womb. So what she's trying to say here, I think, is that her position as midwife is one of great responsibility and it requires courage and skill. So just as a poor sailor might cause a shipwreck, so a precious vessel such as that containing a child should be safely guided into port by an appropriate person. Okay. This can really be the skill of the practitioner. It can mean the difference between life and death of the child and of the mother, as I've indicated and as we'll see in the instruction. Okay. But beyond that kind of medical responsibility, the midwife also has moral responsibilities, and we'll talk about this a little bit more tomorrow. So women of ill repute, for instance, could not become midwives, and we'll talk about the midwifery guilds that enshrine some of these rules in a kind of code in this period. Okay. For instance, on page 176, she reiterates that she will not practice abortion. This is a real source of anxiety that some women could know and perhaps be able to divulge to other women how abortion could be practiced, but she asserts that she will not do this.
Sorry, what
page is that? 176. Same page, she says she won't deal with immoral women either. She won't allow them to give birth in her house in order to hide the birth. She says there's a Christian duty to uphold morality, to act with charity, to counsel the women, and perhaps even find somewhere for them to go. But you must, as a midwife, take care to maintain your reputation for respectability. So, you know, if that is threatened by the question of arts over who you let into your house, your professional status will suffer. Okay. Nevertheless, in general, the midwife should act with charity by serving the poor graciously and not accepting money for them. So 177 indicates that. So there is a vision here of the midwife as servant of the people in the manner of a priest or something of that kind. And, you know, midwifery is a vocation. And we see here evidence of Louise Bourgeois' capacity for compassion. Okay? She says to her daughter, poor women do not have the luxury of a lying-in period before and after birth, so they need to be exceptionally well cared for. Okay? And you'll see that the text is framed with reminders that the practice of midwifery is a divine quasi-priestly calling. It can't be forced on anyone, page 175, and the midwife should act with a confidence that can only be bestowed by God, 192, 193. Okay? So there's a sense that her work is supported by a kind of larger, higher calling. Okay? Now, in terms of her ethics and practice, what we see covered in this text is the example of best practice in the delivery room, don't we? And we can talk about this tomorrow. So page 186, the question of how the room and the woman should be prepared for labour, the bed linen, where the woman should go, what she should eat, how calm the room should be, that kind of thing. Okay. What's interesting, I think, about this information is that it suggests that probably, for the most part, Louise Bourgeois served women of a fairly high status, because she talks about a separate room to give birth in, and for poor women this simply wouldn't have been possible in this period. So the fact that you've got a separate space that you can prepare, with separate bed linen and so forth, separate clothes to wear for giving birth, suggests fairly elite customers, okay, at least bourgeois in status. Okay. What's interesting, I think, about what she tells us about labour on page 185 is that it emphasises her own capacity for empathy and a recognition of practice that involves good management of pain. She talks about le mal d'accoucher as being a mal qui est extrême. Okay, so she acknowledges the suffering of women and she wants to do something about it. And this was by no means always the case in this period, because some viewed the pain of childbirth as a punishment for Eve's sin, essentially. So something that women should learn how to bear. Okay, so we'll look tomorrow at just the layout of the delivery room, the presence of many women often in that room. I might just show you if I can. So this is the birth of Mary, in fact, but it just shows you a busy space, lots of women, a female space, and that, you know, that's essentially what we get described in the text. And the need, therefore, for the midwife to manage not only the woman in labour, but all the other women in the room as well, and all eyes are on her. So, you know, not necessarily always a comfortable position to be in. And in fact, if you look at Wendy Perkins' article, which is on your web, on the bibliography on the web, the relationship between midwife and client, she points out the contractual relationship between the midwife and the mother here. So that kind of complex relationship, power relationship, where the midwife is a servant to the mother, she's a client of the mother, but at the same time, she has to direct the mother. She has to be seen as being in charge, okay? And she points out that it's not always good for a labouring mother to have her own way, but you've got to coax her gently out of it. So, you know, bossing her around is not necessarily the right response. Okay, and you'll see, hopefully, or you've already seen if you've worked on this text, that there's quite a lot in it about the behaviour of mothers and those around them. So the instruction is not just a kind of quasi-scientific text, it's also, I think, a moralising text. Here we have the mother teaching her daughter and her readers about how to read human nature, as well as acquiring the practical arts of midwifery. So, for instance, the daughter is told that she should understand that mothers are frightened in labour, they need reassurance, they need comprehension, and look out, therefore, for examples that Louise Bourgeois gives of problems that arise when the midwife, in fact, doesn't take control. So, despite that contractual relationship, she has to impose herself. So, how should she do that? She should expect to be in a position of power and to use it appropriately. Okay? We'll talk more about this relationship in the seminars. But it might be worth saying to you that lower class women who become pregnant outside wedlock would not normally be delivered by reputable midwives, but rather by disreputable midwives. And Louise Bourgeois is critical of midwives who do this. Now, women who have babies on this basis, these are very often women who then go on to wet nurse in order, as it were, to get some money. So it was often the case that wet nurses would themselves be illegitimate mothers. And there, hence, you know, comes the anxiety about the quality of the breast milk. And on page 182, Louise Bourgeois refers to this kind of breast milk as les amoureux, somehow coming from rather dubious moral sources, and the child would be consequently corrupted. So if you're going to use a wet nurse, you should find a good one, she says. Okay. Okay, what we'll also see, and again we'll talk about this a little bit tomorrow, is some discussion of the responsibility that mothers carry for their unborn child. So how as a pregnant woman should you behave? And I think slightly more in slightly more complicated fashion, she's drawing attention to the fact that a midwife is also someone who is called upon to pronounce pregnancy, to define pregnancy, and therefore she is somehow reliant on her clients being honest. So if you have a woman faking pregnancy, for instance, how is the midwife to determine this? And what are the consequences if she gets the judgment wrong? There are anxieties that really come through the text, and we'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow. But that is all to do with the notion of the body and the boundaries of the body being connected with notions of power, isn't it? You know, reading the body from the outside, whether that's possible or not, that kind of thing. Okay? The position of the midwife in society, then. Okay, we'll talk again about this a little bit tomorrow, the accreditation of the midwife. But in general, then, there's a real anxiety that Louise Bourgeois is articulating about being associated with superstitious, outmoded, and ignorant practice. You know, she does not want to align herself with those women who have learned quack remedies from various people but actually don't know anything at all about anatomy. Okay? So, for instance, Louise Bourgeois warns against keeping the amniotic membrane, which covers the heads of some infants at birth, because, she says, this membrane is highly prized by witches, and therefore might associate a midwife with the practice of witchcraft. And that was an association that was often made in this period. Okay. There are midwives, she tells us, page 176, that will falsely certify a woman as pregnant for money, who will perform abortion. So plenty of women out there who will give midwifery a bad name. Okay. 176. So, Louise Bourgeois says, it's in your interest to differentiate yourself very clearly from these women, page 185. Okay. She also knows, and I think the text makes this very clear, that she's in danger of being put down by the male medical establishment with their emphasis on theory and on scientific knowledge. Okay. So it's that opposition of the oral tradition on the one hand and the body of scientific written works on the other. And of course, Louise Bourgeois struggles these worlds because she's read some of these texts, what I've talked to you about, but she's also a practitioner. Okay. She's also clearly anxious about the increasing presence of men in the delivery room, and she talks about male midwives, doesn't she? A particular midwife called Monsieur Honoré, who pops up several times in her accounts, as we'll see tomorrow. Okay. She really wants to show, I think, that she has absolutely no need for a male midwife in order to practice effectively. Okay. She's also rather anxious, I think, that women should want a male presence in this female space. So she's quite conservative in that respect. She links her own ideas with the notions of pudor, shame, all the rest of it that I mentioned earlier. Men should not be in this space unless there is an emergency. Okay. In order to place herself, I think, appropriately then, between the scientific male world of text and the hands-on world of women, she is inclined to recognise her place in this hierarchy. So, you know, you have your doctors at the top, then your surgeons. Really, the midwives tended to be the bottom of the pile in terms of practitioners, so they're linked with, you know, teak pullers, that kind of practical healer. So she says, yes, it's true, page 187, that we may need, in the case of emergency, to call upon an apothecary or a surgeon. Okay, but she also says, if these practitioners aren't needed, sometimes they can do more harm than good, and she gives examples of that. Okay, and finally, then, to suggests that good midwives should work alongside doctors. So if you've got a remedy that you think works, you should share it, she says to her daughter, with the male medical establishment. Why? Because if you don't, then that establishment will think that you're hiding something or practicing something that's less than entirely appropriate, and you will be, as it were, looked down on as a consequence of this. There's a real fear that midwives were a closed circle of women, and that their secrets, their remedies, their recipes were somehow beyond the domain of men. She wants to kind of break this barrier down a little bit. Okay. And of course, as a writer, she's beginning to do just that by moving her experience into the written domain, as we've said. Okay. And I think, you know, the very fact that she's prepared to give case study evidence in these works suggests that she is a writer who has acquired a kind of scientific method. And I think that's important, you know, because, as I've said repeatedly, these male practitioners often didn't have hands-on experience. And so the fact that she's writing down these case studies brings new knowledge to the field. Okay. Okay. Where are we? Yes. We'll talk about this some more tomorrow. It might be worth saying that some critics of Louise Bourgeois have particularly wanted to emphasise her feminist status because she does a number of things that much later feminism has identified as being pro-women and a rather different way of writing from the male world of writing, the male world of text, if you like. She focuses on lived experience and on the everyday experience of women, something that hitherto didn't appear in text. She allows female voices to be heard in print a little bit. We don't see that much of it in this text, but we see a little bit of that. And she practices empathy. Okay. But as I said, she is also quite conservative in her view of woman's position in society, and particularly in relation to her husband. Entirely typical of the period, but she does believe firmly that the woman's body belongs to her husband. Okay, so finally then, we've gone through all of that, I'll just show you another picture. So everything's rather harmonious here, isn't it? I don't suppose it was always like that. But speaking of harmonious births, just to preempt a little bit the reading that you're going to do for next week's seminar, which is on the birth of Louis XIII, and that text is available online for you to click on and download. And it's an old print version, okay, just to get you in the real habit of reading many Renaissance texts. I'll just give you a little bit of background information about that text just to finish with then. Okay, so the birth of Louis XIII, which comes from the Récit Véritable, so not the instruction that we're looking at tomorrow, but the Récit Véritable, which is in fact next week. Okay, just a bit of background then to that text, and particularly both to reiterate how important the safe production of a male heir was in this period. You have Marie de Médicis, as I said last week, married to Henri IV. He only comes to the throne at all because the Valois dynasty, the previous dynasty in France, failed to produce any male heirs whatsoever. So the Valois dynasty is succeeded by the Bourbon dynasty. And that was a very precarious period of transition. So from 1589 to 1593-1594, Henri IV is fighting to assert himself as the appropriate monarch for France, and eventually he enters Paris as king in 1594. Okay? So he's very popular as a king when he finally comes to the throne, but he's very aware that he needs a male heir to consolidate his position. So you can imagine, 1601, at Fontainebleau, where Louis Bourgeois has been hired as midwife to Marie de Médicis, the talk is all of the question of whether a male heir will be produced. Okay. And what you see then in this text is Louise Bourgeois telling the story of how she aids in this crucial historical moment of producing the male heir that's so long awaited. Okay. okay? So I think, you know, what you can do is see this story that she tells as an example of a midwife's best practice, if you like. So some of the things we've seen articulated in the instruction are kind of demonstrated here. Like, you know, how does she bring calm into this delivery room? How does she avoid the excitement of the mother? For instance, after Louis-Thérèse has been born, she perceived it to be very dangerous for the mother to be overexcited. So, you know, after this long-awaited arrival, it's finally arrived. How does she get a handle on that situation? How does she calm the room? Think not only about the fact that she has professional skills to do this, but that in the room are the king, the princes of the blood, because although traditionally this is a female space, when it comes to a royal birth, that's not entirely the case, as you will see, and various key figures, such as the princes of the blood, were invited to witness the birth, presumably to be able to then, you know, assert that this was indeed a royal prince that came from his mother, as it were. So this is a public event, this birth, and she has to assume control. So it's worth looking at for how she does this. Eventually, 200 people are allowed into the room in which the queen delivers, but only when Louise Bourgeois says so. It's a stream of visitors. What else can we see when we look in this room? There is evidence of some ritual practices that were common in this period. For instance, there's a relic of St. Margaret laid on the table in which the queen's given birth. Now, St. Margaret was the patron saint of childbirth, and particularly important for Catholic women to premature labour. It's interesting, actually, to note that Protestants in the 16th century took issue with the theological validity of prayers to saints generally, and women were, in fact...
Can I just check, are you an hour or an hour and a half?
Given that last week nobody was coming in, we decided that we'd start at 10 past the hour and finish at 10 past. Are you being invaded? No, we've been thrown out from next door. Right. Can I just take your name and I'll leave you
there? Sure, I'll give you a card.
There are also monks present in the room praying on behalf of the queen. What else can I tell you? Given that he's in a hurry to get in. I think all I'll say, just to conclude, is that as you read that work, I think be really aware of how Louise Bourgeois tells her story, how she positions herself, not only as a skilled practitioner, but as someone who is having to juggle then the ultimate in families, the royal family, with the rank and the position and the anxieties and the political consequences and all the rest of it that's involved. So how does she do that, and how does she tell her story? You know, does she perceive herself to be a heroine? What does she emphasise? Is it her professional skills, or is it her kind of social skills, that kind of thing? Come back to that again tomorrow. And I think we better want to close there, don't you? Has anybody got any questions? Just in the last 2 minutes.
The second little.
The second